Okay, so part of the reason of coming to meditation center, the Sangha, is to have support from other people in your spiritual practice. No matter how often you practice, a very valuable part of keeping ourselves on this path to peace of mind is to know that there's other people struggling, practicing, having setbacks and minor triumphs. So the Buddha said that it's important to really surround ourselves whenever possible with other spiritual practitioners. So try not to come to Dharma Punks and leave without touching base with other people, seeing how they're doing and telling other people how you're doing. And if you're shy, just come up to me at the end. So, the theme of this year's talks has, I guess, been discerning which thoughts cause suffering, learning how to get rid of those thoughts, figuring out which thoughts bring calm and clarity, and learning how to keep those thoughts going. And that actually happens to be the definition of the sixth part of the Eightfold Path, which is right effort. So that's what effort is. Keeping track of what's going on in our minds, what thoughts we have, noticing when the thoughts are causing us stress, noticing when we're getting lost in self-centeredness or fear or anger, and knowing how to replace those thoughts with thoughts that bring us long-term peace of mind. So, in that theme, I thought I'd approach it from a different tack tonight. The Buddha was known for a couple of different tendencies in his teachings. Certainly he was known to be, anybody who's actually read any portion of the Pali Canon will attest to the fact that the guy was really repetitive. He liked to repeat himself over and over and over again. Obviously a large portion of that was because it was his teachings were for a long time orally passed down, and it was a part of the oral tradition to repeat every little idea over and over again. But certainly he was known also to repeat the same building blocks or ideas over and over in each of his different suttas, and many times within those suttas, to make sure that people would get the idea. He wasn't afraid to hammer it in. He also was not afraid to make lists. He loved lists. The Four Noble Truths, the Four Bases of Success, the Four Elements, the Five Hindrances, the Five Ways to Get Rid of Unskillful Thoughts, the Six Sense Bases, the Seven Factors of Awakening, the Eightfold Path. Actually, there's a whole book where they literally just took his teachings and broke it down into the one this's, the two that's, the three other things, the four whatever. So that's another teaching technique that he was used. Now the third is the Buddha loved to use analogies. He used the analogy of being a doctor, and he delivered many of his teachings as if he was diagnosing a patient. Now, another analogy that he used, which is one of my favorite, and it's going to be the topic of tonight's talk, is he used the metaphor or the analogy of eating or consuming to describe how the mind works. It's throughout the teachings. The word that we commonly use for attaching, when we say, well, it's all about non-attachment, actually, the word upadana literally means in Pali, the language that the Buddha taught and or was his teachings were recorded in, upadana literally means to consume. To consume. So what the Buddha was saying, when we attach to something, the mind is consuming it, literally fixing on the world and consuming it. And what we call craving, tanha, it was literally a word that had its basis in the word appetite. So to crave is to develop an appetite, and then to attach is to consume whatever it is we have a craving for. So, and even to follow this, the word kamabhogi, which literally means an unskillful person who's completely attached to sensual pleasures, addicted, and isn't aware of the spiritual life or that the importance of developing peace of mind within. That literally translates to actually someone who eats a lot. And nibhogin, which is a word that's not used that often in the Pali canon, but it's used in several important texts. And it literally means, it's commonly understood to be translated as he who has achieved enlightenment, but it also means he who has nothing more to eat. So, and the idea of consuming is throughout. So this metaphor is extremely helpful in learning to see the way the mind works. And a lot of monks, especially Ajahn Jeff, use this metaphor in their teaching a lot. The basic idea is that when we focus on something, we pay attention to something, it's akin to when we cut up our food and prepare it to eat, and that when we think about it, it's like when we're chewing on our food and swallowing it, and then we dedicate these thoughts, these things that we hear in the world, and they become digested, and they become part of us. Now, for example, when you eat food, at one point the food is outside of you. You carve it up, you eat it, you chew it up, and then eventually that food, at some point after digestion, turns into you. It's very difficult to pinpoint that point, but at some point the food in your stomach, not to get too graphic, but the food is digested, the nutrients are taken out of it, and they are delivered by the blood. You can tell how much I know about biology. But somehow it turns into you, whatever. I can only follow this so far down the metaphorical highway. But so food starts outside of you, and then it becomes you. And it's the same thing with ideas. We have a tendency to think all of our thoughts are our thoughts. But in fact, everything we think started from outside of us, got chewed up a little bit, and is now being passed around in our minds. And we like to think, oh, that's my thought, therefore I have to think it. We don't realize actually everything we think came from the outside, came from outside of us. There's a great psychologist, Russian psychologist from the 1930s named Lev Vygotsky, who's famous in the circles of psychology for discovering the basis of how people develop internal thinking. He followed 2-year-old and 3-year-old children and watched them as they started to internalize their thinking. When we're very young, we say everything aloud, and then over time, we internalize the thoughts until we become largely thinking beings. And he discovered that really what children do is they imitate what the people around them tell them and just repeat it to themselves. until eventually this dialogue that we have, our thoughts, are entirely happening internally. But the basis is hearing what people say to us, repeating them out loud until eventually we say less and less of it out loud until we have a stream of thought in our head. But really what we're doing is repeating the ideas, the thoughts, the things that are around us people say, which is why sometimes if you go to another country and you share an idea or a basic thought that seems basic to you to somebody, they'll look at you like, what the hell are you talking about? Because none of those ideas are floating around in their culture. But in our culture, certain ideas have a lot of prominence. There's an entire field of study called mimetics, which is just based on the idea that everything we think is simply being passed around as little memes, little ideas. And they get broken up and restated in different ways, but they're basically the same ideas that are being passed around, like germs or viruses, and they have a life of their own. And there's also, of course, a lot of famous philosophers from, you name it, the semioticians down to the famous postmodern structuralists like Jacques Derrida, who said that all books are is made up of other books. And Foucault said that all philosophy is made up of ideas from other philosophers. So I'm not going to pursue this too much. You get the idea. What's going on in your head is something that at one point in time you paid attention to, you heard somebody speaking, you saw something on TV, you read something, a teacher drummed it into your head, perhaps a Dharma teacher with a lot of tattoos, drummed it into your head, and you chewed on it for a while, you thought about it, and then you swallowed it. And then some of it got digested, and some of it got shit out. No, it didn't. It didn't get shit out. It's just you forgot about it. But obviously, this metaphor brings up a lot of really interesting ideas. The first is, of course, some kinds of food are good for us. This will be news to you. And some kinds of food are bad for us, right? For instance, some food tastes really good while you're eating it, but it's not good for you in the long term. For example, that phone is going to kill me, but for example, food that's loaded with sugar, it tastes delicious. Lots of food tastes delicious, but when we chew it and eat it and digest it, and then eventually it's not very good for us in the long term. It's called junk food. A lot of the things we see in the media, on TV, not all of it, but a lot of the things that's peddled to us is junk food. On the news, they love to lead with, they say, the bloody story. Lead with the blood. And then we're always sold fear, because fear is delicious to the mind. It's like salt and sugar put together. In fact, actually, there's a lot of studies in neuroscience circles that the things the hippocampus, which is the memory part of the brain, remembers are mostly the ideas that we are experiencing with a lot of emotion. The more emotion we experience something, the more we recall it. There's an interesting experiment where they gave people who are in car accidents, half of the people they gave beta blockers, which prevent your body from being emotionally responsive. And they found that the people who were given the beta blockers, who were prevented to have an emotional response, were not haunted by the accidents, the horrible accidents they were with, and were able to forget them quickly. But the people who didn't have the beta blockers, who experienced the accidents with a lot of emotion, actually were haunted. And it became such an obvious divide that they eventually called the experiment off and gave everybody who came into the hospital, I think this was in Sweden, the study, they gave everybody who came into the hospital after an accident a beta blocker, just because they didn't want to risk people having post-traumatic stress disorder. So the things we experience with a lot of emotion, things that are packaged with fear or anger or craving, these are the junk foods of the mind. And we tend to crave them. We love the drama in life. We love to hear about who's dating who, who's breaking up with who, who's a jerk at work. We love the dramas of life because these are the things that the mind loves to chew up. Unfortunately, one of the things we have to learn, obviously, in life, having human bodies, is the things that often taste the best to eat are not the best for us in the long term. Sometimes you got to eat your broccoli and forgo the ice cream, right? That's not to say you have to. You never can eat ice cream, and you always have to eat broccoli, but there are foods that are very healthy for you that don't necessarily taste as fun as, like, you know, the food we want to eat. But and just they're thoughts that are very good for the mind that don't taste as fun. For example, focusing on generosity, gratitude for things that people have done for us, focusing on skillful acts that we've done. The Buddha lists 10 recollections that will always calm the mind in the long run. I'm going to give a talk on those 10 recollections in 2 weeks. But I can tell you one thing all those 10 things have in common. Most of them are not fucking fun to think about. They don't taste that great going down. Nobody's rushing to the, you know, the store to eat, you know, just tofu without anything on it. And sometimes these thoughts, like recollecting times of tranquility. Well, most of us, that's one of the 10 recollections, most of us, given between thinking about ourselves and what are other people thinking about me and what's going to happen to me in the future or recalling tranquility, most of us are going to be like, yeah, I want to think about myself. But actually, in the long term, the Buddha taught that self-centered thinking, worrying about what people think about us, worrying what's going to happen to me in the future, worrying about how much money I have, worrying about things that I should have done in the past but didn't, these thoughts, they don't bring long-term health to the mind. What they bring is stress. What they bring is stress. They bring a mind that is smaller and smaller and less aware and more skittish and unable to focus. That's a stressful mind. A mind, however, that's in good shape is a mind that's calm, a mind that can focus on whatever we want it to, even thoughts that are not as fun as the dramatic thoughts that we prefer to focus on. But these less dramatic thoughts are the thoughts that are the most healthy for us in the long term. This is like a funny thing that happened, or not really funny, it happened a year ago. I was walking with a group of people, and it was in the summer, and I was listening to this guy going on and on, it was during the weekend, going on and on and on and on about how stressful his job was. And just hearing him, and we were walking near the, actually an area where there's a lot of fast food restaurants, and suddenly this guy, and it was a weekend, he was talking about his job. And suddenly this guy stopped and pointed to a person that was standing outside of a fat food restaurant, was clearly out of shape and was sweating and was eating, you know, a hamburger. And it was not a very pleasantly visual sight. But the thing that amused me was, here's this guy on a Saturday and a nice, beautiful, sunny day talking about his job, and then complaining about somebody's out of shape eating a hamburger, right? It's the same thing. It's the same exact thing. If we carry around our stress and focus on it and carry around the dramas of our life and just fixate on them when they're not happening, it's the same thing of making yourself out of shape and instead of exercising the body or exercising the mind, training the mind how to focus on things that are healthy. Instead, we're going for the fat-filled cheeseburger, you know, on a Saturday. So, I think you get the idea. So, I'm going to give you a couple of more ways that we can follow this metaphor. Just like, you know, when we eat outside all the time, we don't know what's really going into the food. So you don't really want to be somebody who eats every meal outdoors, you know, out at a restaurant. There's this gross YouTube video, and yes, I'm a sucker. Somebody at work's always like, ew, look at this. And, you know, well, this is horrifying, you know. I'll, like, look at it. And so there's this video out of these employees of Domino's Pizza making sandwiches and putting disgusting things in it and sending them out. And it became a hugely successful video. In fact, Domino's Pizza forced YouTube to take it down and track down the kids involved and all that and fired them. But it's had a horrible effect on Domino's Pizza sales. But the idea is, you know, we constantly, I mean, we always go outside of the body, always looking for our happiness. We're always looking for it out there. We're always eating out. Day in and day out, we're looking for our happiness in other people, our careers, you know, our relationships, our, you know, how many friends we have on Facebook. How many people do I have now? I have to update my what I'm doing. Right now I'm at a Dharma talk and the guy's really weird. Wait, now I don't know what he's talking about anymore. Uh-oh, I haven't updated in 5 minutes, you know. So we're looking for happiness. We're always eating out. We're never bringing the focus inward, or rarely enough, to address the balance. And eating in is, and I'm really the last person to say this, because I'm a terrible cook. I mean, I for me, my idea is just, you know, buying a bagel and cream cheese. I mean, that's... But anyway, you know, I try to eat at least one meal a day indoors, and I'm trying to redress the balance, right? And this is the same thing we should try to do with our minds. Develop a practice so that we learn to find sustenance, some sustenance within. We don't have to, you know, every moment look for a way to avoid stress, avoid boredom by looking outside. If we do that, then we become dependent. And as Thanissaro Bhikkhu says, the more the mind looks outside of itself, the more actually we take a toll on other people, because we demand that the people we're in relationships with, that they have to act the way we want. Uh-oh, they're demanding something, or they're not doing what I want, and I'm not finding my happiness there, so something's fucked up, or I'm upset with work because not everything in work is going the way I want it to be. The more we have sustenance, nutriments coming from within, a place in the body where we can find peace and calm and tranquility, the less demanding we are of the world to give us all of our nutrients. Now, I'm not saying to entirely. This is about balance. It's not about going into a sensory deprivation tank. In fact, most people, when they're put in a solitary confinement, isolation, they go nuts pretty quickly. I'm not saying this is about redressing the balance. We have a tendency to spend most of our days externally focused, looking for that sense of wholeness, that sense of purpose, that sense of happiness, that sense of, oh, I'm uncomfortable in my body, I've got to focus on my favorite TV show, whatever. We're looking outside of ourselves. We're not working on the stress within. Now, to conclude, what I hope has been somewhat interesting to talk, there are a couple of foods that are good to eat once in a while, in fact, very healthy, but if you eat them all the time, they're not good for you. I'll give you an example. I've actually read, to my horror, as somebody who doesn't eat meat or poultry, that eating tofu all the time is not great for me. I'm still digesting this information. But apparently, although it's loaded with protein, it's also got a lot of other stuff in it that you don't want to be eating all the time. And people who like to eat tuna fish every day, it's probably not that healthy for you because it's got a lot of mercury. Now, if you eat it once a week, there's nothing that bad about it. The same thing, there's thoughts in the Pali Canon and in the Buddhist practice that are very healthy if you don't think them all the time. For example, one would be generosity or trying to be helpful. Sometimes we can try to be so helpful all the time, so involved in our friends' lives, so trying to fix the people around us, that it's at the cost of our own internal peace of mind, where the balance is thrown off. We want to only get involved with other people, with trying to be helpful, only to the extent that it doesn't throw off our own internal practice, our own internal equanimity. So if you're only using generosity or helpfulness, and you're not taking care of yourself, if you're not practicing appreciating your own skills, if you're not trying to work on develop your own internal peace of mind, your own tranquility, you're throwing the balance off. Also, there are certain kinds of food that if you prepare them wrong, they're toxic. For example, there's this fish, blowfish, that in Japanese restaurants, I've never understood the desire to eat it, because if you fix it even slightly wrong, you're going to die, right? But there's people who love eating this food. So you got to know how to, you got to know how to fix it. And the Buddha, in some of his teachings, suggested how powerful doing the death-based meditations are, focusing on the fact that we're all one day, we're mortal, we're going to die. Part of being born, you're going to die. It's inevitable. Reflecting on it makes us spurred into more action. It gets rid of our complacency. But when the Buddha went away on one of his travels, he came back, and a lot of the monks had committed suicide because all they were doing was death meditations, and they got bummed out. And you could see, how that could be a problem if you don't. And so finally he said, you know what, nobody's allowed to do this meditation until they're a stream enter. They have to be a certain point of their practice. So there's certain kinds of meditations we practice, and we really want to do them, and we really think these are great meditations. It would be really cool if I could do this, but they're not bringing us peace of mind. All they're doing is making us stressed out. So it's very important to be... to see if you if your meditation is working. See if it's working. If you're focusing on the body and all it's doing is bringing anxiety, focus on metta, on loving kindness. Focus on sending thoughts of goodwill to somebody. You don't have to eat a food that's creating an imbalance in you. You don't have to focus on a meditation topic that is going to bring you stress. And so finally, I'm going to conclude with, it's important to know what state you're in when you meditate, to know what kind of food you need. For instance, if you're somebody who's low on energy, they might need to eat a protein bar. But if there's somebody who's been too high on energy, they might not want to do that. They might want to eat something that's not a protein bar. The same way, if you find you're very agitated, your mind is racing with thoughts, that's not the time to focus on all the people that you could help. That's not going to make the mind calm down. In fact, what will work is simply focusing on the breath, relaxing the breath, or focus on a part of the body that's calm. On the other hand, if you find that you're very sluggish and tired, or you're feeling unmotivated, you're feeling like you can't get out of bed, that's a great time to think of, like, times you've been skillful, how helpful you can be, opportunities to be generous to yourself and to other people. So learn to read what state you're in, and what kinds of thoughts you need to focus on, what kinds of ideas. This is about bringing your own peace of mind, your own tranquility. You're the person who has to diagnose your own mind. I can't do it for you. You have to see what state you're in and then know what kinds of thoughts will bring you the lasting strength and calm that you need for a good practice. So that's my talk on consuming, the mind consuming. And now it's your turn to share what's going on.
Thanks, Josh. For somebody, this question is coming from somebody who is really bad at remembering the list that you always mention. And when you started this talk, you said that the awareness for knowing healthy thoughts and knowing unhealthy thoughts is called effort.
Right.
And I wanted to know why that's effort. That doesn't make any connection in my mind from remembering that.
Yeah. The Buddha, when he defines each of the Eightfold Path, when he gets to right effort, he says right effort is the case where the practitioner sees thoughts that are unskillful and puts the effort in to not bring them about, or when they have been brought about, puts in the effort to get rid of them. And the effort involved is considerable. The last actual words of the Buddha before he died was remain heedful. And then he went on to say, treat yourself like an island. Focus within, see what's going on in your body, in your mind. Learn to read when you're agitated, when you're causing yourself stress. Learn to see when your thoughts are unskillful. And then learn to cease those thoughts and to bring about thoughts that are skillful. Now, it sounds like, in terms of the effort we normally talk about, which is like being outside with a sledgehammer on a chain gang or whatever, it doesn't sound like that requires a lot of effort. But in fact, in a spiritual practice, that requires enormous effort. Because instead of allowing ourselves to walk around in our day-to-day lives always externally focused, it requires putting in the effort moment by moment by moment to remind ourselves that the state of the mind is affecting how we're perceiving the outside world.
But I'm not saying that I figured this out, but I'm asking, like, aren't there other points on the Eightfold Path that could also then be called effort?
Yes.
That's all I'm trying to say.
Oh, yeah. For example, right intention is almost exactly the same thing as right effort. When you read the Buddha's description of it, it's once again seeing thoughts that cause suffering, not thinking them, and seeing thoughts that bring about peace of mind, like harmlessness, and bringing them up. In fact, you're right. Of the thoughts, of the Eightfold Path, at least half of the path could be described that way, which shows how important learning to see what you're thinking about, what is going on in your mind and body, to see how it's affecting the way you perceive the world, how it's creating stress, and then learning how to change those thoughts for thoughts that don't bring stress. That's literally that's literally almost littered throughout all of the Eightfold Path. But it just happens to be also the definition that the Buddha gave specifically for right effort.
Thank you.
Sure. Hi.
So you're dealing with effort, and you meditate every day-ish, and you're putting a lot of effort in, and reading, and practicing inside yourself, and then you're out in the world, and you're having altercation, and then how do you deal with all of a sudden this altercation, and all of the, you're not breathing, you're not looking in, you're just having an altercation with someone who's in your face, and you're right there, and then the next thing that happens is the effort is, man, I suck at all of this, I can't do this, what have I been doing? And so how do you rectify effort in reality, in real world, and out of your mind, out of your body?
Well, the first is that, I mean, to take that specific example, which is a great example, obviously one of the most unnecessary parts of that is the story that you're telling. The first thing the Buddha would say is like the whole telling a story of self about it, turning a specific event into this is who I am. I've just had an altercation, therefore I suck at meditation, spiritual practice, and I'm not a good person. That tendency to globalize a single event and not see all the other events of your day where you didn't have an altercation, where you acted skillfully, where you were thoughtful, where when somebody needed advice, you gave it. When somebody on the street needed directions, you gave it to them. Instead, we always cherry-pick the most dramatic event of the day and globalize it and not see all the other events from the day and which don't fit into our global story. So the first thing, if you're going to throw away any of that, is practice not globalizing the events of your life. That's a great way to start. Just experience these events as single events that don't discern, that don't turn into statements of who you are. Right? The second thing is, of course, mindfulness, which is before we get into it, if we have a practice going on when things are going well and we're not in an altercation of seeing, you know, having that one part of the body where you're checking in and you're just seeing your shoulders or your stomach and just noticing when it's starting to get tight, that's a great time to say, you know what, I gotta put this discussion aside.
That's interesting about that.
Hmm?
Okay, so Sam and I are together.
Right.
And let's say we're in a group altercation, like something, you see it coming.
Right.
Perhaps at a dinner table, for example. And
this is totally hypothetical, right?
And as this group conversation at the dinner table is going on Easter, for example, at the family, the altercation is, I see that Sam, for example, might be getting a bit, like, I'm noticing his reaction. I'm doing exactly what you just said, like, notice it all, but I'm doing it for him. So I put my hand on his knee to say, don't go there, calm down, feel a bit. But then I take off. Right, and just do all the things. So I've recognized all of those things for somebody else, but then no control over. And then the whole thing just, you know, fireworks, explosions, and none of them, you know, really quite pleasant.
Yeah, because you basically ate his food. And you got the results of what would have happened. You know, you basically grabbed his mental food, what you saw that he was about to chew on, and you ate it. You focused on it, and you swallowed it, and then it turned into, you know, it turns into the inevitable. There's a metaphor and with alcoholism that, you know, you take that drink, and you immediately, you're launched in. It's unstoppable. It's the same thing with certain thoughts. You see the thought, and the moment you start to think it, that's it. It's all over. I had somebody call me up on the phone who literally the moment he starts to tell the story about his depression immediately goes into it. And that's it. He becomes the depressed person. He becomes unable to get out of bed. He becomes unable to focus. Up until that moment, when he thinks the thought in the day, he's fine. But the moment he starts saying, oh, I'm a depressed person, or that's my, he bites, he takes a bit of that, the result is inevitable. It's just as if he gets on a train and there's no more stops, it's just taking him directly to. So the trick is to see, for an alcoholic, to see that drink and to know you can't take that drink. If you have a thought that you cannot take because it's going to lead you to suffering, do not chew on it. Even if your mind is saying, that thought is true, this person is an asshole, right? I'm sitting with an asshole. But you know, if you chew on anger, for example, you are going to be you're going to be gone. It's just going to whisk you away. Or if you chew on that thought of, you know, I have depression, or you chew on that thought of I am alone, or you chew on that thought I don't have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, begin to see which foods are poisonous for the mind. Right? And even if Sam or everybody else is like chewing on that food and you know that they might suffer, you don't chew on it. Because it's up to you to be the guard of your own mind, not Sam's.
Thank you.
Thank you. All the way in the back.
Hi. Thank you for tonight's teaching.
Thank you.
How ironic that you were talking so much about eating and consumption, because I've been fasting the past 2 days. Everything you're talking about, I was like, cheeseburger, I want to have. Yeah, bagel would be good, too. So I'll break my fast tonight a little bit, too. But I wanted to ask you a little bit, and this is a little off topic, but it does relate a little bit. I wanted to ask you a little bit about thoughts and when sort of like other people's karma intersects with your own karma. I think I've shared in the Sangha in the past couple of months that my father's terminally ill and that he's been alienating myself and also my brother a lot from this process. And he seems to, it just seems to be too emotional for him to see us. And but it's also very difficult for us because we love him very much and he doesn't have that much time left and we want to spend some time with him. And through discussions with my brother, what we sort of come to figure out, and this is where I feel like I'm attaching to a story, and yet there is a truth to the story, is that it may be that my brother and I, although he loves us very much, we remind him of the time in his life that he feels a lot of guilt and shame about, and because he's dying now, because he's feeling very emotional and he's in a very weak and vulnerable state, it's just too unbearable for him to see us. To have these memories come back to him. And so that's sort of one of those thoughts that, like, you know, when I think about that, it's just, it's very sad and it's quite tragic. Both my brother and I are at this place where, like, we don't want to confront him. We're not looking to resolve any past. Like, we just kind of want to tenderly be with him some. But he seems to be really frightened of us. And frightened of the tenderness or the emotion that might come up in him if he interacts with us. So it's hard because, you know, sometimes when I mean, it's fucking depressing. You know, when I think about it, I get really bummed out. But I do also use some of the tools that I've learned here and other places. And, you know, I have to think about times that were really great with him. I have to think about times even in this whole environment where things are nice. And a long talk with my brother the other day, we basically talked about, I mean, we basically took care of each other when we were children, but we basically were a family unto each other. And I found myself saying to him, like, well, if I only had, like, one person as a family, I couldn't have chosen a more amazing person. But I do feel very much that it's like, my storyline is getting so wrapped up in my brother's and my father's, and I try to have some peace and extract from that, but it's quite challenging. And so, and it's not all gloom and doom, you know, there are these moments, you know, I was saying to somebody the other day, I was like, I feel like dying is kind of like anal sex, like everything is hyper amplified. You know, like, either, it's a strange analogy, but like, when it feels good, it feels really good. When there's something a bit off, it's horrible. So that's kind of where I'm at. Like, when I have these moments of joy, it's really, and I remember this actually after my mom passed away, like, I have such tremendous relief when I have moments of joy, whether they come from something within myself, a thought within myself, or something like external. Like, I do sometimes, like, I'm so with my cat. My cat is just precious and personified. But it is sometimes hard to get myself away from those thoughts that are quite dark. Seem so enmeshed in some of people's karma that I care so deeply about. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions about how to sort of gently pull these things apart without really wrenching myself into the karma.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull my mind out of it. You had me for so long, and then the anal sex thing, and I'm just thinking of one joke after another. I will say one thing. Oh boy. All right. I will say that at the beginning you said one thing that's really interesting, amongst all the interesting things, but one thing that I'm fascinated on right now, which is this need we have when we're experiencing something that's painful to have this sort of generative story to explain, you know, okay, like my father, he is not talking to me because he's remembering a parts of his life when he was unskillful, and I'm reminding him of it. You know, this, it's sort of like I watch this show on TV called In Treatment, which is a show about this psychiatrist, and the whole point of the show is waiting for that moment when the psychiatrist is going to say, "Aha, it's your anger at your mother," and it goes, "It's my mother," and then they're all cured and they can go on, you know, whatever. So, but it's still fun watching. There's this tendency we have, though, to think, wow, if I could go back to that moment, pinpoint why this is happening, that's somehow going to be helpful, that having an explanation is the real part of the work I have to do to make this easier for me. And actually, what I'm beginning to see is actually that while I understand why people do that, sometimes just the thing we need to practice is compassion. And when somebody's acting unskillfully, know that they're suffering. And we don't need to get into the practice of telling or figuring out what the story is or why they're doing it. Just see, oh, this person is suffering. They've obviously done something unskillful in their past. It's their mind now is acting as a result of this, and my job is, rather than to turn this into resentment that I'm going to have to repeat in my head over and over again, to just remember that they're suffering, and my role here is to practice compassion. Now, I don't think there's anything particularly unskillful with what you've done, because you've used that story to develop compassion, but I just think that over time, you'll need to less psychoanalyze and just spend more time when you're thinking about it, just reflecting on the fact that this is a person that is obviously acted very focused on unskillful things at one point in his life. And this is the result. And to feel compassion about it, but to learn from it. That's partially one of the most valuable things. My own father died very, very recently, within the last couple of weeks. And he did practice Buddhism, and he did come a long way. But still, at the very end, a lifetime of worrying about money, right up until the very end, he was, even when he was blind, he was opening up the financial section and pretending to look at Wall Street numbers, even though he couldn't even read them anymore, because that, just doing that, made him, you know, feel like he was connected and he knew what was going on with his money. He had that much karma attached to it. So I learned from that, you know. I saw that, and I'm gonna take that into my life and see, wow, this is what happens when you spend so much of your life fixating on this. When it comes time to let go, what my dad still was doing every time I saw him, every Monday, was sitting with the financial section. Even as he was losing his life to Parkinson's and he had no financial worries, that's what was happening. So I don't know if that was helpful, but...
be able to be of service to other people that I know when the time comes that they might be going through similar experiences. So I do want to learn whatever I can from the experience. So thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Okay, we have time for one more, and might as well be Cliff.
On the subject of the parents, I've been sort of considering moving closer to my parents. And I'm wondering if just in general terms, you could sort of sketch out what, like from a Buddhist point of view, your duties or might be towards your parents, or what would be a good amount of energy to devote to them as balanced with yourself. Like, how do you approach that from a Buddhist angle?
Well, there is actually a lot of teachings in the lay practitioner sutta which talk specifically about how to regard one's parents. And in fact, the Buddha often talked about the importance of reflecting on gratitude, even if your parents have in certain ways been extremely unskillful, to at least have some gratitude for your birth. And the idea behind that is you don't want to go through life harboring huge, completely unmitigated resentment, if that's what people have, you know. To have at least some gratitude mixed in there, the more the better. The Buddha talked about it, how important it is to develop gratitude towards one's parents. So it's not for them, it's for us. Because if we have this place of nothing but resentment, even if our parents have been very unskillful, it's important. Now, in terms of the more important question, which is balance, how much to get involved, I mean, you're the arbiter of that. Nobody can reach into your mind and say, for me, it was once a week. You know, my dad was a very challenging person who did a lot of unskillful things when I was very young, and still very much late into his life, despite the fact that he tried to meditate and stuff like that, and he earlier on practiced meditation, he did a lot of unskillful things. So I saw from my own experience, and my sister did too, that we could handle being with him once a week. And that was all we could see him. Now, there are people that can only see their parents once a year, and there are people that can live with their parents. So I can't give you a general rule. What you have to do is see how disruptive they are in your spiritual practice and in your mind. What kind of havoc, if any, is created by being sucked into people's dramas? How much you find your mind pulled in or pulled out of itself into their lives? Or, you know, how much they push your buttons, as it said. And only you can do that. And that's what's going to require your heedfulness. You know, find the place in your body that registers stress. Start with your meditation to notice, or during the day to notice how many times you're thinking about them as opposed to the stuff you should be thinking about. Are you thinking about them when you're not with them? These are great signs to tell if the balance is being thrown off. I got with seeing my dad once a week, you know, we had it set up so he had people helping him and assisting him so I could live the rest of my life when I wasn't there, not pulled into his life. But when I was there, I could really be with him. So, you know, that's for your practice to determine. Okay, so let's end with a very quick meditation. And thank you so much for being here tonight. So closing your eyes, finding an upright position, letting go of everything you've heard. If it's important, it will stay with you. Bringing your awareness back into the present moment. Hearing the sounds of the rain. kind of all the recollections and thoughts that the mind can feed on, there is no more nutritious or skillful thought than metta, unconditional friendliness. Wishing ourselves and other beings true happiness. This is a, if there's any kind of mental food that's always safe to consume, this is it. So first, remembering that true happiness comes from within. May I be truly happy. May I be peaceful. May I be free from stress and suffering and fear. May I be safe. May I live with ease. May I be truly peaceful. Just let these thoughts float from your mind down into your body, relaxing. May I be truly peaceful. May I be free from stress and suffering and fear. Reciprocal part of this practice, knowing that true happiness comes from within, wishing other beings true happiness doesn't take anything away from us or any other being, it just wishes that all beings will find true peace through skillful actions. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free from stress and suffering and fear. May all beings live with ease. May all beings be truly peaceful. Let's take a moment to reside in whatever feelings, state of ease that these thoughts bring about. So next week is Noah. So you might want to come a little bit earlier. Because generally there's a packed house to see him. So thanks for listening, and I'll be here next week to listen myself, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. And I hope to see you again.
If folks can stack the cushions against that back yellow wall, and the blankets go on the racks or back by the door.